So we are 2 days before Hanukkah, and I would like to speak about Hanukkah from a number of points of view. But it is also Parshas Miketz, and I'd like to spend the beginning part of this year relating to Parshas Miketz. I have a Ksava Kabbalah in my notes. If it stays there any longer, I think my notebook will explode. So the beginning of Miketz, of course, of Paro's famous dreams, the cows, and the wheat. And Paro has these dreams. And when he wakes up, Perek Mem Aleph, Pasuk Ches, he is most perturbed. Vayhi baboker, Pasuk Ches of Perek Mem Aleph, in the morning, Vati Poimucho, his spirit was perturbed, disturbed, Vayishlach, he sends and calls for anyone who can help. All the wise men, all the diviners. He tells them his dream, no one can help him. Rashi comments on the word vatipa emrucho. It's a very interesting word. And the word vatipa'im, if we look for the root, comes from the word Pa'am. What is the meaning? Rashi begins by quoting Unculus. Vatipa'im rucho umetarfa ruche. Okay. For some of us, that may leave us no more enlightened. What does umetarfa ruche mean? Umetarfa means something is banging or clanging. Mikashkeshes besocho kepa'amon. The word vatipa'im does relate to pa'am. Pa'am in the sense of the root of the word pa'amon. Pa'amon is a bell. And the reason why pa'amon is a bell is because it clangs rhythmically. Pa'am. And therefore his spirit is clanging within him like a bell. Okay, that doesn't sound too good. Then Rashi says, Ube Nebuchadnezzar. It's interesting to compare this clanging with another dream that led to clanging, and that's Nebuchadnezzar in the beginning of Sefer Daniel, Perek Beis. He has his own dream, that figure with the head of gold and then the body of silver, etc. and so forth. And he also didn't know what it was about, and it's very similar, the psukim. There it says, Vatispa emrucho. Almost the same word, but there's an extra tough. Instead of vatipoem, it's vatispoem. What are we to make of this? This extra tough. Says Rashi, quoting from the Medrash, Lefi shehayu sham shtei pe'imos. You see, with Nebuchadnezzar, there was actually a double problem. Namely, not only did he not know what the dream meant, he also forgot the dream. If we think Paro in this week's Parsha was in a bad way, so Nebuchadnezzar was Apkaktatsaurus. He didn't know anything. Not only did he not know what the dream meant, he couldn't even remember what it was. I mean, he was literally at zero. And therefore, he has two problems. What does it mean, and what did I dream? Corresponding or reflecting these two problems, so whereas in our parsha, it says vatipa'em with one taf. When it comes to the Nebuchadnezzar, it says vatispa'em with two tafs, because he had two problems. Shichachas hachalom, he forgot the dream, v'ha'alomas pisrono, and he had no idea what the interpretation was. So briefly, what Rashi is saying is that Paro has one problem, represented by the one taf, and the Nebuchadnezzar has the double problem. And thus he gets two tafs, vatispa emrucho. All the Mefarshi Rashi, Mefarshi HaMedrash, are wondering how does it come to be that the extra taf gives us an extra problem? If anything, it maybe sounds like it changes the meaning of the word grammatically if we know a thing or two about the grammatical constructs. Vatipa'em is a nifal, it's a passive. Vatispa'em sounds like a reflexive. That doesn't help us at all here. Grammar is the last of our worries, and the last of Nebuchadnezzar's worries, that's for sure. But this extra tuf somehow contains within it an extra problem. What did this letter tuf ever do to anyone? That it's another problem. Some explain, Mizrahi, that by adding the extra tuf, it's as if the pasuk is to be read vatipa'em twice. Because he had two problems. But instead of saying vatipa'em, it says vatispa'em. It compacts the two problems into one. Okay, others are not so happy with that explanation. Just to make things worse, the pasuk states in the beginning of Daniel Perek Beis, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, Vatispa'em Rucho, and we know what that means. He forgot everything. He didn't know what the dream meant. He didn't even know what he dreamt. Then it says in Pasuk Gimel, he calls all of his wise men and says, I had a dream, Vatipa'em Ruchi. Those are Nebuchadnezzar's words, as expressed in the Pasuk. Now, that actually makes it worse. Because the whole point of what Nebuchadnezzar has got to tell them, that he doesn't know the dream, no one can start, he can't tell them the dream. He has to tell them he's forgotten the dream. And if you forgot the dream, that's the two problems. That's the two tufts. The Pasuk itself told us, Vatispa'em, he had two problems. How can he not tell his own advisors that he has two problems? It's a non-starter if he doesn't tell them, he doesn't remember the dream. So Nebuchadnezzar has ruined everything. Because he's only said Vatipa'em Rucho, or to put it slightly differently, he clearly hasn't learned Rashi and Parshas Miketz, because if he did, he'd know that the way to express that he has both problems is to say Vatispa'em, so it sounds like he doesn't have a problem, but of course he does. So once we finally arrived at an understanding of the two tufts, how come Nebuchadnezzar, at the critical moment, took one of them out? That's a good Shiloh. Into the fray steps the Ksava Kabbalah. And he says as follows. There's a very interesting insight into this, you know, forgetting of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. The Medrash Tanchuma tells us that Nebuchadnezzar did not forget his dream. If you have a dream like that, you do not forget it the next morning. But he's telling everyone that he forgot his dream. Why does he say that? The answer, says the Tanchuma, is because Nebuchadnezzar wants to separate the men from the boys. He wants to separate the talented interpreters from the wannabes. If he tells them the dream, and this now becomes a challenge, so they'll be queuing up for the whole length and breadth of Bavel. This will have his interpretation. I mean, one can only imagine. The head is of gold, the torso is of silver. What can that possibly mean? Nebuchadnezzar doesn't have all day. And therefore, in order to edit the interpreting process and to cut to the chase, he decides something else. The one who can really interpret my dream will be able to tell me what the dream was. That's how I can whittle down the queue from thousands to maybe the one or two that I really need to be speaking to. So that's an interesting initiative on Nebuchadnezzar's part. He said he forgot the dream. All of a sudden, everyone has to be somewhere. But Daniel came in, and Daniel told him what the dream was. He's the person that Nebuchadnezzar was looking for. Under normal circumstances, it could have taken Daniel weeks till he finally saw him, because he's hardly going to be first in the queue. That's very interesting. How do we see this? Says the Ksava Kabbalah. Let's come back to the word vatispa'em. Grammatically, we noted in passing, it's a reflexive. The notion of reflexive is to do something to oneself. Like lehitrachetz is to wash oneself, lehitabesh to dress oneself. But there is another usage of the hispoil, of the reflexive. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Zayin, Yesh mis asher, ayin shin resh, from the word ashir. You can have someone who's mis asher, ve'ein kol. He doesn't have anything. What is the meaning of the word mis asher? You can have a person who mis asher means he has nothing, but he presents himself as wealthy. He makes himself out to be rich. He doesn't have a penny. Also the converse, says the Pasuk. Misroshesh, from the word rash, poor. Misroshesh, vahon rav. He makes himself out to be a pauper. You see him, you give him a penny. But he's sitting on a fortune. Misroshesh, vahon rav. He has a fortune. What do we see from that Pasuk? The use of the reflexive can sometimes be to denote someone who creates a certain reality, even though it doesn't exist. They make themselves out to be a certain way. The reason why it's the reflexive is because it's not rooted in reality, it's rooted in the person. It's generated by the person. He creates his own wealth in the sense that he creates the fiction of his wealth or the fiction of his poverty. That's called the reflexive. It begins and ends within him. So with this in mind, we understand, perhaps in a new light, why the Pasuk adds a taf in Daniel to tell us to talk about or refer to Nebuchadnezzar forgetting the dream, because he didn't really forget the dream. He made himself out to forget the dream, and therefore his trouble was self-generated. His trouble began and ended with him. So Vatipa'em, passive, means he was really troubled. Vatispa'em means he created a trouble for himself. He made himself out to be troubled. That's why the extra tough refers to the forgetting of the dream, because it was fictitious. So that's very interesting. And it also explains to us now very clearly why when the Pasuk describes what happened with Nebuchadnezzar, it adds the tough, Vatispa'em, because the Pasuk is telling us that he made it up. He made up that he forgot the dream. But of course we understand that as he comes to talk to his advisors, he will say, Vatipa emruchi. He's going to drop the taf, because he's not telling them that he's pretending to have forgotten the dream. From his point of view, he's telling them that he really has forgotten the dream. So he will never add the taf, because he's telling them that it's real. The Pasuk is telling us that he made it up. That's the transition from Vatispa em, which is the reality, that it was made up, to Vatipa em, which is lie, that it was real. Okay. The Ksava Kabbalah hasn't finished yet. When we talk about the Nifal and the Hispa'el, the passive and the reflexive, so one thing we should know, as soon as you hear it, it resonates, but until someone points it out, we may not have noticed. It tends to be that when you have a word in the Nifal, like in the past tense Nifal, the accent of the word is always in the middle. For example, lihilachem is to wage war. Vayavo amalek vayilochem. It's in the middle syllable, vayilochem, in Yisrael. Or similarly, in our parsha, vayhiba boker vatipoem rucho. That is standard for the nifal, that the syllable comes back to the middle of the word, vatipoem. Not vatipa'em, vatipa'em. Okay. In contrast to that, the hispoil always has the accent at the end. Like we say, lehit vayit palel. Or later in this week's parsha, Yosef is an accent strange to his brothers. Vayisnaker alehem. With the hispoil, with the reflexive, the accent is always at the end. That's the rule. Says the Ksava Kabbalah, there's only one exception in the whole of Tanakh. There is only one place where the word is irreflexive, but the accent is in the middle, not at the end. Where is that, we ask ourselves? Daniel Perik Beis, where it tells us that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he was troubled, says the Pasuk, Vatispoem Rucho. Not Vatispoem, even though it's irreflexive. Vatispoem Rucho. What does this mean for us? It says the Ksava Kabbalah, this is the full setup for what Chazal are detecting for us that Nebuchadnezzar had two problems. The use of the reflexive tells us that his problem was made up. Were it to be passive, it would be real. Like when Paro is bothered in this week's Parsha, it's real. Vatiporim, he really is bothered. When it comes to Nebuchadnezzar, does he have a real problem or not? If he has a real problem, it should be the Nifal. He really is impacted. If he's making it up, it should be the reflexive. He's making it up. Well, when it comes to Nebuchadnezzar, is he making it up, his problem, or does he have a real problem? The answer is yes. Because there are two issues here. One of them is real, and one of them is made up. He really doesn't know what it means, but he does. He is only pretending not to remember the dream. And therefore, how will the Pasuk communicate to us that what was disturbing Nebuchadnezzar was one aspect of it was real, and one aspect of it was made up? The answer is, if it's real, it should be a Nifal. If it's made up, it should be reflexive. And if it's both, it's both. Namely, the word is written grammatically as a reflexive, but the accent is pulled back, which is appropriate for a Nifal. Because that's how the Pasuk is telling us that both are here. On the one hand, there's an extra tuf, it's reflexive. He's making up part of it that he forgot the dream. On the other hand, part of it's real. He really doesn't know what it means. And that is reflected by the pulling back of the accent from vatispoem, which is pure fiction, to vatispoem, which is part fiction and part real. That is how to learn Rashi. These are the comments of the Klava Kabbalah, and for us again, it's chinuch from the greats. For those of us who would not have noticed that there's one place in the Tanakh where there's a reflexive that has the accent on the penultimate syllable, for that we have the Ksava Kabbalah. Okay, so from there, let's come to talk a little bit about Chanukah. And I'd like to discuss for a few moments a halachic issue that comes up by definition every Chanukah, sometimes twice, certainly at least once. Namely, what to do on Motzei Shabbos. Now, on the one hand, and just general comments before we get to the confrontation between Chanukah and Havdalah. So, as a general rule, when at all possible, if at all possible, one should try and light within the first half an hour after Tzeisa Kochavim, after nightfall. And to that end, the widespread minhag is that even shuls, where the minhag generally is perhaps to daven ma'ariv a little bit after Tzeisa Kochavim on Motzei Shabbos, to wait a little bit for Tosefet Shabbos. But on Motzei Shabbos Chanukah, generally speaking, all shuls daven bizman, which means that one doesn't have the entire half hour, but as much of the half hour as one can. And moreover, just on a practical note, it is highly recommended that the preparation of the wicks and the oil, etc., for Motzei Shabbos should be done on Erev Shabbos, which allows one to come straight home and find all the lights ready to light. Okay, those are practicalities with regards to the menorah itself. But now, dare I say it, the burning question is, when it comes to Motzei Shabbos, you have two mitzvahs before you. You have the mitzvah of Havdalah, and you have the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. Which one comes first? And this is a raging discussion amongst the Rishonim and Acharonim. And the reason why is because when we come to ask the question, which should come first, both Havdalah and Chanukah lights each seem to have a quality to them that should make them come first. Things that are well known to us. On the one hand, when we consider Havdalah vis-a-vis Ner Chanukah, we note that Havdalah is much more common. Havdalah is every Motzei Shabbos and Motzei Yom Tov, whereas Chanukah is eight days a year for Chanukah. And that puts Havdalah into the category which is called Todir. Todir, as a general rule, that which is more common comes first. Todir v'she'enu Todir, Todir Kodem. It's learnt from the Korbanos, actually. The Korban Tomid, the daily offering, comes before anything else because it's daily, because it's Todir. It comes before Musafim or anything else. So Havdalah, it has to its merit that it's Todir. On the other hand, you come up against a mitzvah like Chanukah. Chanukah has an outstanding characteristic, and that is Persume Nisa. Persume Nisa to publicize the miracle, gives it outsized strength vis-a-vis other mitzvahs. So now the question is, when you have a confrontation between Havdalah, which is Tadir, more common, Ner Chanukah, which is Pirsumei Nisa, which one of them will go first? Interestingly, the Gemara discusses such a confrontation. It discusses someone who doesn't have enough money for both Chanukah lights and wine for Kiddush. Imagine such a person. He has to choose. His money for that week will either go on wine for Kiddush or Chanukah lights. Well, wine for Kiddush is Tadir every week. Chanukah is Pirsumei Nisa. Says the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Kaf Gimel Amud Beis, he's got to go with Chanukah. Pirsumei Nisa Odif. Pirsumei Nisa wins out. It is indispensable. And for that week, he won't be able to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush over wine. Okay, there's nothing you can do because his money has to go on the oil and the light for Chanukah. So it seems that we have our answer. Pirsumei Nisa takes precedence over Tadir. QED. However, the Tosfos add a fascinating comment here. Namely, the Gemara only said that we choose Pirsumei Nisa, Chanukah, over Tadir, in that case Kiddush, when you can only do one. It's going to be one or the other. If you have to choose one, and if you don't choose it, you won't do it at all, then the Gemara said, you've got to choose Pirsumei Nisa. You can't do without Pirsumei Nisa. However, should you have a question, not so much of which one to choose, for you'll be doing both of them, but it's now merely a question of which one will go first, says the Tosfos, we haven't yet seen that Pirsumei Nisa should have to make it first. You never know. Maybe the opposite could be true. Maybe we'll say, Acharon, Acharon, Chaviv. You can say what you want. But Tadir always comes first. And therefore, says Tosfos, do not conclude from the fact that if you can only do one of them, you choose Pirsumei Nisa, that if you can do two of them, when you're doing both of them, Pirsumei Nisa must come first. Not at all. Rather, says the Tosfos, we revert back to Tadir v'sheinu Tadir, and whatever more common comes first. Relating that to our situation, therefore, if Tadir goes before Pirsumei Nisa, Havdalah, which is Tadir, will come first. And indeed, there are Rishonim who rule that way based on this principle, that Tadir will always come before Pirsumei Nisa, the Sefer HaEshkol and others. What's very interesting is, alongside this discussion as to which should come first, Havdalah or Chanukah, Tadir or Pirsumei Nisa, there's a parallel discussion. How can there be another discussion? I mean, there's only one of them could go first. There's only two of them. How could there be another factor in the equation? Well, interestingly, the other discussion, which takes place in the Trumas Hadeshin, is not that the order is determined by which should go first. It's actually determined by which should go last. That's where it comes. In other words, the most compelling point in this question may be which one to do second, and then, de facto, the other one will come before it. What do we mean by that? Because remember, says the Trumas Hadeshin, we're talking about Havdalah. Now, what do we know about Havdalah? So let us reference a well-known halacha, happens once in a while, when Yom Tov falls on Motzei Shabbos. So then everything happens together, what's known as Yaknahaz. What that means is when you make your Kiddush, but you're also making Havdalah, and you put it all together. Okay. Now the Seder is, first you make Kiddush of Yom Tov, and then you make the bracha of Havdalah. For Motzei Shabbos, Hamavda bin Kodesh l'Kodesh. So that's very interesting. Kiddush you make first, and Havdalah you make second. But consider, presumably, the new day doesn't start until the old day, until the previous day is finished. Wouldn't it be more intuitive first to finish with the earlier day, Havdalah, and then to move into Kiddush? Why do we reverse the order? The answer, says the Rashbam, commenting on the Psachim, Daf Kuf Gimel Amud Beis, if the Gemara says in a number of places, if you have a number of things to do on Motzei Shabbos, Havdalah should be last. So as to delay the bringing out of Shabbos. The longer you can wait before you have to say goodbye to Shabbos, the better. In the words of the Gemara, Afuke Yoma, seeing the day out, Ma'acharinan. We try and delay it as much as possible. So if we're looking for things to do, well, I mean, if you have things to do, Kiddush, so let Kiddush come first. So just that you can say Havdalah, that bit later on. Hafukeyoma ma'acharinan. We delay saying Havdalah. Says the Truma Sadeshin, this is the critical point. If ever you have two mitzvahs to do, and one of them is Havdalah, you've seen from the Gemara, don't think about which one to do first. Think about which one to do second. Havdalah always comes last. So then, de facto, your order will be first Ner Chanukah and then Havdalah, in order to delay the saying of Havdalah. So says the Truma Sadeshin. And this ruling of the Truma Sadeshin is actually codified by the Shulchan Aruch. And Siman Tafresh Pei Aleph, Si'if Beis, the Shulchan Aruch says, first Ner Chanukah and then Havdalah. Shulchan Aruch says it about in Shul, right, in those Shuls where they made Havdalah. I believe there are still some around. First Ner Chanukah, then Havdalah. And the Rama says, and similarly at home, first Ner Chanukah, and there Havdalah. What's interesting is, you may notice that we don't do that. The common practice, actually, is first to make Havdalah at home, and then Ner Chanukah. Not like the Shulchan Aruch. Where does that come from? Well, the Turei Zav, the Taz, has a lengthy discussion accompanying this ruling of the Shulchan Aruch, and he cites the Maharal of Prague, who cited often in the Turei Zav. The Maharal did not light Hanukkah lights first. He would make Havdalah first, says the Taz, and let me explain to you why that is. You see, the reasoning of the Truma Sadeshin, why would we do first Hanukkah and there Havdalah, is because we seek to delay as far as possible, reasonably possible, the making of Havdalah. So anything that we can shtup in, you know, first, that's all the better. Like we see with regards to Kiddush of Yom Tov, we first make Kiddush of Yom Tov before Havdalah for Motzei Shabbos. Says the Turei Zav, I'm not sure you can draw an equation between that case and our Hanukkah case, for a simple reason. To say that you make Kiddush of Yom Tov before you make Havdalah of Shabbos, in order to delay making Havdalah, because you're holding on to Shabbos a little bit more, that is reasonable. Because the Kedusha of Yom Tov is not inherently antithetical to keeping hold of Shabbos. It's true that this year Yom Tov is the next day, but Yom Tov can fall on Shabbos also. So to make Kiddush of Yom Tov, it's not a non-Shabbistic act. So you're still maintaining the Shabbos state for a few moments longer. However, says the Turei Zav, if you wish to delay the making of Havdalah, that is to say, to hold on to Shabbos a little bit more, and the way that you're doing that is something which is fundamentally non-Shabbistic, like lighting candles, so you haven't really held on to Shabbos because you're doing malachas. You're delaying the making of Havdalah by doing malachas. So making Kiddush is one thing. Lighting a fire is quite something else. And therefore, if the only reason is to delay the making of Havdalah, that's not a reason. And therefore, says the Turei Zahav, if the delaying device is Ner Chanukah, we do not use it to delay Havdalah, and thus we revert back to our question as to which one comes first, and the answer is Havdalah, because it's Tadir. And this is the approach of the Turei Zahav. It's interesting to note, before we reach the final matter of Minhag, just one further consideration, which is raised by the Avnei Nezer, the Sokot Shavu Rebbe. It says, Avnei Nezer, it seems to me that he concurs, quote-unquote, with the Shulchan Aruch, that is to say, first Ner Chanukah, but for a completely different reason. Namely, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos and Daf Kavches that if one has two mitzvahs, opportunity to perform two mitzvahs, and you wish to know which one to do first, if one of them will end before the other, you do that one first. If it will expire before the other, you have to take care of the one that will expire earlier first. It's known as Mitzvah Overis. I mean, the time is of the essence with regards to that mitzvah. Now, bringing that into our situation, says the Avnei Nezer, Chanukah, there is great insistence on lighting within the first half an hour. Which means that first half an hour, it's not the same after that first half an hour. That gives Chanukah, vis-a-vis Havdalah, I mean, Abdullah can, if necessary, go until Tuesday morning. And certainly one has the whole night. There's no notion that to make Abdullah specifically, there's no insistence within the first half of an hour, and nothing like there is in Hanukkah. And therefore, if you have these two mitzvahs in front of you, Hanukkah is mitzvah overis. You've only got half an hour. Time is of the essence. And therefore, he says, one should light Hanukkah first, and then Abdullah. Although, this is quite it's quite a statement to make of the Avnei Nesef, because as we know, the halacha is that if one did not light within the first half an hour, although some will say you can't light at all, Rambam and Vilna Gaon, but the Shulchan Aruch says you should light within the first half an hour, but if you didn't, you have the whole night to light, and you can light with a bracha. And therefore, the question is that first half an hour, the desirability of that first half an hour, does that confer upon Ner Chanukah the status of mitzvah overis? Some people perhaps would say no, which is why this idea was missing from the discussion until the Avnei Nezer entered the scene. So we have before us now plenty of discussion on both sides. Presuming Issa, Todir, Delaying Shabbos, Mitzvah Overis, and opinions on both sides, plenty. So much so that when it comes to the final halachic decision, the Mishnah Berurah says you can do what you want. Which is quite rare for the Mishnah Berurah to say that. His terminology specifically is, there's so many poskim on either side, da'ovid kamar ovid, if you did like one opinion, you're fine. Da'ovid kamar ovid, if you did like the other opinion, you're fine. If only everything in life was like that. That you can't possibly go wrong, because you have plenty of people supporting you on either side. That said, later poskim note that the widespread custom actually is to make Abdullah first. The Aruch HaShulchan says it in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and that certainly seems to be Minag Yisrael, to make Abdullah first. But interestingly, in the Shul, the Minag remains Ner Chanukah first. Why is that so? So just our final comment here, it's a very striking comment. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, it's quoted in the footnotes of Shmir Shabbos Gilchosa in Volume 2, Chapter 58. That lighting Chanukah lights in Shul is different than at home. How so? Lighting the menorah in Shul is a minhag. Only a minhag. Or more correctly, a minhag only. And by that we mean, no one fulfills their obligation through the lighting in Shul, because you have to light where you live. No one lives in Shul, so then no one fulfills the obligation. It is pure minhag. And therefore, because it's pure minhag, there's something about minhagim, they have a special chavivus, that they always come first. Whereas chiyuvim are more subject to the hierarchy as which should be first and which should be second, says Rav Shlomo Zalman. Let me illustrate. Of the Megillus that we read in Shul, one of them is a chiyuv, only one of them is a chiyuv. That is, of course, Megillus Esther, it's a mitzvah. The others, Shir Shirim on Pesach and Koheles on Sukkos, etc., Rus on Shavuos, they are minhag, and minhag only in Shul. And you will note, interestingly enough, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, that on those Yomim Tovim, we always read the Megillah first. You read Rus before Leining. That may be news for some people who've been staying up all night, but Rus is read before Leining. That's what happened. And Shir HaShirim is read before Leining on Pesach, and Koheles is read before Leining on Sukkos. On Purim, first you Lein, and then Megillah Esther. What changed the order? Because Purim is a mitzvah, and if it's a mitzvah, so then you're back again to Tadir and the entire machinery of which comes first. But Minhagim have a special place in the hearts of the Jewish people. Minhagim always come first. Those other Megillah, Shir HaShirim and Koheles, they're Minhagim, they come first. And therefore, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, lighting the menorah in Shul is a minhag, it's like reading Shir HaShirim. And therefore, it comes first. Lighting at home is like Megillas Esther, and it may end up coming second. So these are some of the highlights of the discussion, which comes up, of course, it's important to have to know what to do practically, of course, first and foremost, but also to have perspective. And these are some of the discussions that took place. So from the halacha to perhaps the essence of the day, I'd like to talk just for a few moments about the miracle with the oil. Of course, we celebrate it, and the Chanukah was never the same since, and it's 8 days because of the miracle of the oil. And we're wondering a little bit about this miracle of the oil. What was it for? Did it help us? Did we need it? Were we in trouble without it? Were we in danger? It doesn't seem so. I mean, that's an important part of the story, as much as when children tell the story, and so they should, when they couldn't find pure oil, and it was a disaster, it was a tragedy. So they turn the whole place upside down to look for the pure oil. Anyone who has a halachic knowledge will know that if you can't find pure oil, you just light impure oil. I mean, that's the litvish answer to the question. That's the truth. The halacha. So it's difficult to say that we were in danger, because we were in danger of what? Of performing a mitzvah in a perfectly satisfactory way, given the circumstances. The Rambam introduces the mitzvah of Chanukah in a very interesting way. Sorry, he doesn't introduce it, but he said, if I'm not mistaken, it's the end of Hilchas Chanukah. Mitzvah Chanukah, mitzvah chaviva hi ad ma'od. The mitzvah of Chanukah is especially beloved, extremely, ad ma'od. And that's where there are extreme halakhas about Chanukah. A person needs to put themselves out to procure at least the basics for a mitzvah of Chanukah beyond what one needs for other mitzvahs. Because it's the mitzvah chaviva ad ma'od. Why is the mitzvah of Chanukah chaviva ad ma'od? It's obviously a very open question, but many mitzvahs could be described in that way. That's a lot to say about all mitzvahs. To understand one aspect of why this mitzvah is such a beloved mitzvah, this mitzvah of Chanukah, we need to go back to the first Chanukah. That is to say, the first Chanukah Samishkan. Chanukah as a word, before it divides up into a gematria, as a word, Chanukah means dedication, inauguration, beginning something. The very first Chanukah, it's the laning, it's the Kriyas HaTorah for Chanukah mornings, Parshas Noso. So it's Chanukah Samizbeach. It's the inauguration, the dedication of the Mishkan. If we follow the contents of that Kriyas HaTorah of Parshas Noso, we will note that the korbanos for those first 12 days were rather unusual, or some of the korbanos were rather unusual, unheard of in other settings. For example, I mean, the psukim, of course, we know, certainly by the end of Chanukah, we know. Every nasi, every day, every nasi brought kaf achas, asara zahav, melea keteres. Everyone brought a container of keteres, each nasi. Keteres can never be brought by an individual. There's no such thing. But for these opening days, there was. And each of the nasiim brought a chatos. No one ever, you can't volunteer to bring a chatos. It's only if a person did something wrong. And you shouldn't volunteer to do something wrong. So that the idea of a voluntary chatos, it's unheard of. But it was the daily fare for those first 12 days. What does this mean? Clearly, we are come face to face with the concept of hara'as sha'a. It is a temporary measure. It's a one-off or 12-off, right? Just for that time. It doesn't represent normative halacha at all. Hara'as sha'a. Okay. Now, Hara'as Shah normally has a just cause, shall we say. There's normally something behind a Hara'as Shah, these like unusual measures. They're not there arbitrarily or spontaneously. What is the measure of these Hara'as Shah, these unusual korbanos? The answer is to be found in a Rashi, in Shir HaShirim, in Perek Hei, Pasuk Aleph. The pasuk reads, "Bosi lagani achosi kala." I came to my garden, achosi kala, my sister, my bride. Orisi mori imbasami. I collected more, which is a type of spice, imbasami with other spices. Achalti ya'ari im divshi. I ate the cane with the honey. That's the pasuk in Shir HaShirim. And like most pasukim in Shir HaShirim, we don't really know what it means. Rashi explains, Rashi is quoting the Medrash, Basi Legani, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking, I came to my garden, where is Hashem's garden? Bimei Chanukas Habayis, at the time of the dedication of the first Mishkan. So this pasuk describes the uniqueness of that opening, of the Mishkan. The Pasuk says, Arisi Mari in Besami. I gathered more together with other spices, meaning beyond the spices that I would normally gather. What does that mean? V'ne'emar Hashem HaKetores. Hashem says, on those opening days, Basi Lagani, I collected, that is to say, accepted more spices than usual. Normally, Ketores can only be offered by the Tzibur. But on this, on these, for these days, Arisi Mari in Besami. Shektiru Ketores Yochid, even individuals. V'hudover She'enu Noik L'doros, that never happens on an ongoing basis. It will never happen again. And moreover, the Pasuk says, Achalti Ya'ari Im Dibshi. I ate the cane together with the sugar. The Yaros Dvash here, as far as Rashi is concerned, they're sugar canes, they're not honeycombs. Others say it's honeycomb. But the point is, what's the norm? If you ever have a honeycomb, you don't eat the whole... If you ever have a sugar cane, you don't eat the whole cane. You take the sugar out, you suck the sugar out, and then the cane is discarded. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, V'ani... Meirov chiba, out of great love for Bnei Yisrael, achalti yarim tivshi. Whatever they offered, I accepted. In other words, they offered karbonos that would never normally be acceptable. They're the cane. Normally, I would only take the sugar. But for those 12 days, meirov chibosi, out of love, everything was acceptable. Well, almost everything. I think this gives us further context into the atmosphere that led to the problems with Nadav and Avihu, who died on the first day of the Chanukah Samishkan. And they died because they broke a lot of boundaries. But we need to appreciate that there were a good few boundaries that were broken, and it was okay. But even when, as those boundaries were being broken, there were others that couldn't. But at least the background to Nadav and Avihu, they just took it one step beyond the beyond. But in any case, this Rashi has given us a way of understanding the background, Or the measure of this horas shah. What does it mean that there are korbanos? They can never be brought, and now they're brought. It's not obligations, and it's not further chiyuvim for the time. It's an expression of the chiba of the time. In other words, normally you have to be very particular what you bring. Anything that's not acceptable is out. But things that are normally not acceptable became acceptable. The cane became eaten along with the sugar. Meirov chiba. It's an expression of Hashem's love for the Jewish people as they're starting out the Mishkan, that He accepts more than what otherwise would be rigorously be vetted. That's very interesting. Not only is it interesting in terms of the light that it sheds on those 12 days, but because it sets a theme that will recur again. The Rambam says, in the end of the second parak of Hilchas Maase Korbanos, if you look in Sefer Yechezkel, and he describes the Korbanos that will be brought in the third Beis HaMikdash, we don't recognize many of them. And they seem to be deviations from the norm. And what does he mean to say? Is this a new sacrificial order? As far as the Rambam is concerned, that's impossible. I mean, the Zos HaTorah Lo Teimuch Lefes, the order of Korbanos is set. It's not going to change in the third Beis. So what are all these Korbanos of Yechezkel? Says the Rambam, these korbanos that Yechezkel is describing are the korbanos not of how things will be in the third Beis HaMikdash, but they're describing the Chanukah of the third Beis HaMikdash. Every Chanukah, says the Rambam, you should note already, has unusual korbanos. What type of unusual korbanos will there be in the third Beis HaMikdash? Well, one can only imagine, says the Rambam, so imagine no more. That's the same for Yechezkel. Seven of this type of chattas and seven of this type of ola, that's the uniqueness of the Chanukah of the third bias. And moreover, says Rambam, if you take a look in Sefer Ezra, you will note that when they came and inaugurated the second bias in the time of Ezra, there were also unusual korbanos, as are described in the Gemara in Hurrius. And what's interesting is There's a thread that runs through all of these unusual korbanos. They all accompany and define the Chanukah. And it's for the same reason, achalti ya'ari im divshi, that there's much more scope for different types of korbanos at the time of the Chanukah, meirov chibosi. So in a sense, probably the most correct way to say it is that a departure from the norm of korbanos is the norm for Chanukas. So it was in the Mishkan, so it was in the time of Ezra, so it will be in the time of Yechezkel. Now, acharei hadvarim ha'ele, and Shlomo had his own. The first day was explosive in terms of how Shlomo did his Chanukas habayis of the first Beis Hamikdash. Acharei hadvarim ha'ele, we have to come back now to this one Chanukah that needs to be examined, namely Chanukah. That is to say, the essence really of Chanukah is the rededication. It's called Chanukah first and foremost because it's the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash. It had been profaned by the Greeks, and the whole thing had to be started from the beginning. And it was a Chanukah. Now, based on what we have seen, every Chanukah has a certain departure from the norm in terms of its korbanos, as communicated by the Navi. In the Chumash, it was Moshe. In Ezra, it was Ezra. For the third bias, it's Yechezkel. And now we come to Chanukah. We just have one problem. There's no Navi. Meaning, it's the first and only time that you have a Chanukah of the Beis HaMikdash, but you need a Navi to tell you exactly how the Korbanos should work. It can't be arbitrary. It can't be just whatever people decide. But the territorial problem is that we're dealing with a stage where Nevuah has ceased. I mean, halfway through the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, there is no Nevuah. And therefore, it seems as if this element of Haras Shah, of deviation from the norm, as normally expressed in unusual Korbanos, is missing. But it can't be missing, because the time of Chanukah is a time of Chiba. And that Chiba needs to be expressed. So we're stuck in Chanukah, because how will it be expressed if the vehicle for expressing it, i.e. Nevuah, is absent? It can't come out. Says Pachad Yitzchak, if it doesn't come out in the departure from the norm of Korbanos, it will come out in another way. The principle is, and this is now the stunning point of Rav Huttner and the Pachad Yitzchak, there exists a significant connection and relationship between Torah and the world. The famous words of the Zohar HaKadosh, Istakel Ba'araisa Ubara Alma, Hashem looked into the Torah and created the world. That means that the world reflects, the reality of the world reflects the reality of Torah. For our purposes, Torah has rules, and so does the world. What that means is that the rules of the world correspond to and parallel the rules of Torah. If the world parallels Torah, then the rules of the world parallel Torah, the rules of Torah. And then you have a concept called a miracle. And a miracle is a suspension of natural law. Where does that come from? So the Furtner, if you think about it long enough, will appreciate that if the rules of the Torah correspond to the rules of the world, then a suspension of the rules of the world, otherwise known as a miracle, corresponds to a suspension of the laws of Torah. Momentarily. Do we find such a concept? A temporary suspension of the rules of Torah? We do. That's a Haras Shah. That's when the Navi comes and temporarily overrides the rules of Torah. Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel. The korbanos of the Chanukah Habayis, their Haras Shah. A miracle is the natural parallel or the world parallel to a Haras Shah of the Torah. Haras Shah suspends the rules of Torah, and a miracle suspends the rules of the world. And therefore, if the Chiba, Basi Lagani, as the Chanukah begins, that the beloved nature of that beginning expresses itself in a suspension of the laws, just to show how Ahava overrules the normal law. So in the other cases, it would overrule the Torah law and result in a harasha of unusual karbonos. But for that, you need a Navi. If you don't have a Navi, then it will overrule natural law. And the result is the miracle with the oil. In other words, the suspension of natural law, that amount of oil should only last for one day, but it ends up lasting for 8 days, that is the harasha in the nature of the world. That is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed the chibah. What in other circumstances would be accepting unusual karbonos, in this circumstance would be having the oil burning for an unnaturally long time. Achalti yari im divshi. And this gives us a whole new appreciation, says the Pachad Yitzchak, with regards to the miracle of the oil. Because it was through the miracle of the oil that HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed his love for the beginning, for the re-beginning of the Beis HaMikdash. And that, says Afutner, is what is behind the formulation of the Rambam, who says that the mitzvah of Chanukah is mitzvah chaviva ad ma'od. It's a specially beloved mitzvah. Why is it an especially beloved mitzvah? Because it's coming to commemorate a miracle that was itself an expression of love. In other words, the very fact that the oil lasted for 8 days, it was there in order for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to show his love for the Beis HaMikdash beginning again. The mitzvah that commemorates an act of love is a beloved mitzvah, ad ma'od. So this is the unique, I mean, Rafutner really came into his own in this respect. And that's his perspective with regards to the nature, pardon the expression, the nature of the miracle of the oil and its implications for the special quality of the mitzvah of Chanukah. On a slightly different vein, to understand again what's the miracle about? We could have done without the oil lasting for 8 days. The Jewish religion would have continued. And the miracle isn't performed for nothing. The confrontation between Yavon and Torah is described in the Medrash with the words, Kisvu lachem al keren ashor. They said to the Jewish people, write for yourselves al keren ashor, on the horn of an ox. And there's many interpretations as to what horn of what ox, but Kisvu lachem al keren ashor, she'en lachem chelek belokei Yisrael. That you have no portion with the God of Israel. The sticky point between Yavon and Torah, and it became all the more aggravated because Yavon and Torah have so much in common. I mean, they both appreciate many of the same things. That makes it all the more unpleasant when Torah says that the Jewish people are connected to something much higher, because that already takes the entire realm of wisdom and everything to a much, much higher level, whereas for Yavon, that is the highest level. So we can never really get along. But it has to be identified as a confrontation. And therefore, Yavon is saying, if you can be prevailed upon to give up or to be disavowed of the connection that you're looking for, chelek belokei Yisrael, then we'll be best of friends. You'll probably make very good Greeks. And certain Jews did. I mean, the Jews are the best of these isms. If they can relinquish Chelek v'lokei Yisrael. And really the war, therefore, I mean, why go to war? The war of the Hashmonaim against Yavon is saying that they're going to war as a statement about, we're not prepared to relinquish Chelek v'lokei Yisrael. To do so is to dissolve the concept of the Jewish people. For what defines the Jewish people is their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the Torah. And then they went to war. HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped them, performed a miracle for them, and they were victorious to the extent that they were at that time. And then they came to the Beis HaMikdash, v'achakeim bo banecha. And the next thing that happened was this miracle with the oil. So what's very interesting about the miracle with the oil is that we tell the story and it was an open miracle. Nothing like that had ever happened before. Nothing like that would ever happen again. I mean, oil was only meant to last for a certain time, lasted for much, much longer. It was a truly stunning event. But what's interesting is, as is pointed out by the Pnei Yehoshua in the second parak of Masechta Shabbos, it's not entirely true to say that nothing like that had ever happened before. For actually, something like that happened regularly with the menorah. There is the concept of the Ner Tamid, which is the Ner Ma'aravi. That is to say, that every container of oil in the menorah was contained enough to light for the entire night. The Ner Ma'aravi routinely stayed lit until the next evening, twice as long as it was meant to. Not 8 days, but twice as long. The others went out, the same amount of oil, and it burned for longer. So it's very interesting, because now if we're looking to place the miracle with the oil, it's not a new type of idea at all. It's actually an old type of idea. And that's exactly the point. It's a throwback to the Ner Ma'aravi, obviously in highly expanded terms. But the principle is the principle of Ner Ma'aravi. For what is the principle of the Ner Ma'aravi? The menorah, as the Gemara says in Shabbos and Daf Kaf Beis, why is it that this amount of oil would always burn longer than the rest? Eidus leboi olam, it is testimony to all of those in the world, shehashchina shora b'Yisrael, that the divine presence rests within Israel. The ultimate Eidus, the testimony, are the Luchos HaBris, but they're behind the curtain. But what is visible is the menorah. And therefore what the Ner Ma'aravi, which is really the archetype of this miracle, it's about Eidus HaShchina Shor B'Yisrael. When the Hashmonaim fought for that connection, as if to say, we're being prevailed upon to say, Ein lanu chelik b'lekei Yisrael, but we're not prepared to do that. For that we'll go to war. Because Yesh lanu chelik b'lekei Yisrael. We are connected to Hashem. That's what defines us as a people. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded in kind with Eidus HaShchina Shor B'Yisrael. By the fact that the oil lasted so much longer than it should have, which is a throwback to the Ner Ma'aravi. So this gives us a new perspective. Really, it's a message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem was really endorsing the decision of the Hashmonaim. You were right to go to war, because this is indispensable. The Shechina is yes, Sherub Yisrael. And therefore, again, we say the mitzvah of Hanukkah is mitzvah chaviva ad ma'od. It's especially beloved mitzvah because it commemorates a miracle that was there purely to show that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is together with the Jewish people, is connected together with the Jewish people. From a certain point of view, it's like the Anane HaKavod. Hanukkah is always connected to Sukkot. So the 8 days of Hanukkah, like the 8 days of Sukkot. And Beis Shammai say that the lights go down, descend in number, just like Pari HaChag. There's a lot of discussion about the connection between the Hanukkah and Sukkot. But I think in this respect, they're fundamentally connected because Sukkot is also a zeichah for Anane HaKavod. Anane HaKavod were Eidus Shashchina Sherub B'Yisrael. After the Eagle, they went away. With the Mishkan, they came back. When the Shechina is with us, those Ananim are with us. And that took the form of the miracle with the oil, which was Eidus Shashchina Sherub B'Yisrael. And therefore, that's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu shows his special connection to us. And a mitzvah that marks that expression is a mitzvah, which is Chaviva Ad Ma'od. So that, I believe, is something to reflect upon as we perform this very beloved mitzvah for the 8 days. We are reaffirming, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu told that to the Hashmonaim, and it became fixed as a holiday every year for Bnei Yisrael, it's because the Jewish people, as we go through the Golos, need to be reminded every year, Sheshchina Shor B'Yisrael. The Shechina is together with Yisrael, and we need it a lot. And Mitzvah Hashem, the more we are aware of it and the more we do our part to promote that connection, the firmer it will become and the more this will be one step closer to the Gula Shelema from Heri Yomeinu Amen.